This is an audio archive edition of Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, sevillepodcast.com.
Our guest in this hour includes Jerome Armstrong. It does include, and that's who the guest is. Jerome Armstrong has been called the blog father. Jerome joins us on the long line. Jerome, where exactly are you?
I'm up in Alexandria.
Oh, there you go. Well, you're home, and you're headed off to, is it Las Vegas? Is this weekend?
Yeah, we're going out to Las Vegas on Wednesday. The yearly Coast Convention is out there for a bunch of bloggers from nationwide to gather over the weekend.
Well, that'll be great. We definitely want to talk about that during this hour. Just want to start by saying thank you. I'm honored to have you here and honored to be talking with you, and I want to thank you for taking some time out to chat with us. If you have a question or comment for Jerome Armstrong, the number is 977-1070. Again, 977-1070. Jerome, the best place to start is for folks who might not know who you are and what you do, really. You've been called the blog father, which is quite a nickname. Give folks a little, you know, Jerome Armstrong 101.
Yeah, it stirs up something along the lines of the mafia, doesn't it? I started political blogging about politics in 2001 and was one of the first ones, you know, on the block doing that sort of thing. And it quickly became a community of people that were commenting on the blog that I was writing, and it sort of spurred into being the kickoff area for Howard Dean's campaign in 2002, and much of the local, what we call Netroots organizing, which is organizing that happens over the internet, similar to what happens offline and grassroots organizing, happened around the blog that I had in 2002 around Howard Dean's emerging campaign.
So you were one of the internet strategists behind the Howard Dean campaign, is that right?
Right, yeah, and I helped, Joe Trippi reached out to me, and we helped put together the whole strategy that Howard Dean worked with his campaign, and then I went out and joined him and worked on his national staff in Burlington, Vermont.
And how did you come at this? I mean, do you have what put you in front of a computer such that you've been political blogging and really put this on the map?
You know, I wasn't really political before this decade. I followed politics, but didn't certainly work beyond the volunteer level. But I just remember, you know, during the whole Florida fiasco in 2000, just being sucked into watching every detail, and the internet was the best place you could get the news for that happening. And I hadn't really thought much about George Bush's presidency, but beyond what he said he was going to do, which was be a uniter, not a divider. We remember that great slogan. And it didn't turn out that way at all. And the direction that he's driven the country is something I was just very appalled from. And so I became involved in trying to change that.
Jerome Armstrong, our guest, the political blogger, is sometimes called the blog father. His site is mydd.com, and he's the co-author of a new book, Crashing the Gate. And we definitely want to talk about that. Well, let's just do it. Tell us first who you wrote the book with, and then
sure.
Where the title comes from and what the book's about.
Well, I wrote the book with Marcos Melitzas Zuniga, who is the blogger at probably the biggest blog in the world. It's dailycoast.com. And Marcos and I had been working together on different projects ever since 2002. We came out of the 2004 election just really frustrated. We supported John Kerry and thought that he had a great chance to win. Certainly on the issues, people agreed with the majority of them, agreed that John Kerry had the best stance on the issues. The majority of the people felt that the country wasn't heading in the right direction, but nevertheless, George Bush got a majority of the votes. So what we set out to do was to find out, you know, what's going wrong with the Democratic Party and how can we fix it? And what we found was, and we described this in the book as gates of closure, you know, there's just many places where the Democratic Party has been stuck. And there are forces, which we talk about with, you know, that are sort of unleashed in the blogosphere and on the blogs and through movement organizations that are trying to change that.
Jerome Armstrong, our guest, and Crashing the Gate, of course, is I guess it's all about trying to fix the Democratic Party and what's wrong with the Democratic Party, and we'll explore a little bit of that. You're also working with the Warner PAC as I guess the campaign for the nomination for the presidency with the Democratic Party, and that we're going to want to talk about that as well.
Sure. Yeah, I am. I came off the Dean campaign, and I guess I didn't get enough of it. So I'm here for another round, and I hope Mark Warner does run for the president. Right now we're involved with the Forward Together PAC, and he's helping out a lot of the 2006 candidates for election this year.
Jerome Armstrong, our guest, the blog father, our guest in this hour of Charlottesville Right Now, taking your calls, comments, and questions at 977-1070. Jerome, hang with me. Let's take a quick break. This is Charlottesville right now.
You're listening to the podcast of Charlottesville Right Now with Poi Barefoot. Podcasting of the show is made available by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network.
We're talking with Jerome Armstrong, the blog father. His site is mydd.com, and he's the co-author of a new book, Crashing the Gate, which basically, Jerome, am I wrong in saying that it's sort of you could tell somebody if you hand them the book, this is a loyal Democrat to the core who takes a very critical look at the Democratic Party today and gives his educated advice about what's wrong and how we might fix it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the general gist of it. The point of view that we have is being in this whole vanguard movement that's online with the blogosphere in politics. But you can look at it in many fields across the different areas and how the Internet is basically transforming different parts of our society.
And how exactly is it doing that? Is it? I know that there's networking going on. Mm-hmm. Ideas are getting out there that may not be getting out there. And I thought it was interesting in the Salon article, which we'll get to. George mm-hmm. Washington University political scientist Michael Kornfield said that the political bloggers are now the agenda setters for the mm-hmm. agenda setters.
Yeah. Well, what it used to be that you would read a newspaper to find out what was going on television or in politics, and then we had cable television, and that sort of became the latest breaking news about politics and the cable shows. But now what's happening is the internet has basically made it a 24/7 part of our lives. If you're into politics, you want to know what's happening, the latest, you go into the internet and you find about it on a different blog site or a website. And so it's really become the place for the communication to happen.
Yeah, and it's certainly been an important part of my radio program. As I'm trying my best to get people to understand that these political blogs, especially in Virginia, mm-hmm. they're not going away, and you're only going to see more and more of them, and you need to be able to know how to get to them, how to read them, how to interpret them, how to understand them, which ones to take serious. So I actually interview a lot of bloggers, try to get them on the radio, because they are having an impact in politics.
Yeah, it was fascinating to watch the blogs come up from nowhere during the 2005 election here in Virginia and cover the politics and be taken seriously, because a lot of those people that were writing about the politics were very knowledgeable about what they were writing about.
Let's move chronologically. I'd like to start with the Dean campaign. Mm-hmm. Because you were behind the scenes on that campaign in many respects, mm-hmm. what was Dean doing right? And it had to be more than what did Dean represent? Because I know the mainstream party bosses didn't like him. He sort of came from the outside, and they didn't really like that. And it had to be more than just that scream that did him in. Or is it? Was it just that simple?
Well, what Dean did right was that he opened up to the blogosphere, to this new sort of politics, which wasn't about who was inside, you know, especially inside the Beltway and who knew the latest rumors, and it was just sort of in the network of the party's infrastructure. But it was more wider than that. It was anybody who wanted to get involved via the internet. It didn't matter where they lived or what their background was, they could get involved. And he opened up to that, and he was the only candidate, frankly, in the primary amongst the Democrats that did so. So he had a real huge advantage, and all the other ones sort of just sit back and watch this thing as it grew and grew and grew. And that sort of openness to the blogosphere really allowed people to embrace Howard Dean, and it became much more of a movement, bigger than Howard Dean himself in many ways. That drew up a lot of resistance within the Democratic Party, all of this new influx of people, and they had strange ideas like competing everywhere. You know, and small donors that massed together millions and millions of dollars, it sort of upset the whole apple cart of how a presidential race is won. And that, you know, I think those sort of tactics just took aback the Democratic Party as a whole, and it became, you know, very fragmented over the issue of Iraq and, you know, where the party was going as a direction, and it became very combustible in that regard. We refer to it in the book as the Civil War. And the outcome ultimately was that we lost the primary with Howard Dean, but we went through and backed Howard Dean. He had the largest party backing ever with the party, but he lost nevertheless. But Howard Dean did go on then afterwards and regain the Democratic Party chair of the DNC, and has taken that agenda that he carried with the presidential race into the party, and we're trying to reform that now.
Did you experience, Jerome Armstrong, our guest? Jerome, did you experience some of that negative reaction from the Democratic Party bosses firsthand?
Well, it was, you know, I don't think it was necessarily firsthand. It was, and it wasn't ever against like the politics necessarily or the policy positions that Howard Dean has. It was just a probably the basis of it all was just a fearfulness. You know, there's just a lot of misconceptions that were going around as to who the bloggers were, and I think for the most part the party's over that. There was a discussion we had and a debate, obviously had in 2003, but from my standpoint anyway, it seems like people are more tighter than ever within the Democratic Party that look, the blogs, it's part of the universe within the political party and actually helps the Democratic Party quite a bit by being able to be sort of the rapid response to what has been an overpowering Republican machine for the whole decade that we've had in terms of the media.
Jerome Armstrong, our guest, the site is mydd.com. And the book is Crashing the Gate. Let's talk some specifics about the book, Crashing the Gate. Tell us some of the things that you and Marcos, your co-author, identified that could be fixed with the Democratic Party, okay. Some of the challenges that you've identified.
Well, what we did was go out on the road and just spend a lot of time doing, you know, journalistic reporting. And we came down to three different factors within the Democratic Party that we think need to be restructured. The first is we have a lot of special interest groups or constituency groups, and we didn't approach this from disagreeing that reproductive rights should be in the control of a woman. But what we said was, look, we have to approach this from a movement, realizing that we're progressives together and that if Democrats win, the progressive agenda will be helped along, even if some of the Democrats don't agree with us 100%. So this idea of moving away from our silos of our special interest groups and being black and white and making candidates check off boxes to realizing we're part of a greater movement here. The second would be the consultants in D.C. and the way that they've run campaigns, and they're not adjusting to the fragmented media landscape that we have now and haven't really adapted to the changing campaign tactics that the Republicans are using with innovative uses of technology. And so we go through a lot of those examples in our book. And the third one is the vast right-wing, what we call the vast right-wing noise machine, or that's been written about well by David Brock, for example, on the Republican noise machine. And this is something the Republicans spent a couple decades building up. And meanwhile, the Democratic Party just sort of assumed that they were the party of governing and that they would always be in power, and we didn't really respond to this. And it came to just, you know, override all of the media coverage of politics, and it allowed the Republicans to frame the debate, frame the issues, and really set it up to where the Democrats were at a strategic disadvantage. And so we described some of the ways that the Democrats are, our Democratic-aligned groups are responding to that, and certainly the blogs are a big part of that.
Jerome Armstrong, our guest, mydd.com. Crashing the Gate is the book. I'm interested in what you say about the right-wing noise machine, and I guess we're talking about the development of think tank, the Heritage Foundation in the 70s, and this all of this money poured into these think tanks that just start churning out article and op-ed after op-ed after op-ed, and they redefine issues, they turned liberal into a dirty word. In the political landscape, they were very effective in things like the quote-unquote death tax. I mean, there's a great example. They
sure
redefined this tax and used words like death tax. I guess that's where you're going, what you're talking about.
That's right. And the way they have been able to move that message into the voters' minds by being able to stratify it and target it to different voting, to different groups. So Rush Limbaugh will be able to go with the same message into his crowd that listens to him, his 20 million listeners, but the Wall Street Journal will talk to the business crowd with that same sort of message. And so they've targeted across the many, many areas that really is an effective strategy.
Now, for folks who might think that is a conspiracy theory, they literally all get the same memos, don't they?
I mean, and they have weekly meetings, and they're all on the same page. See, what they've done is they've realized, you know what, we might have individual disagreements here and there, but if we work together, we're going to all succeed a little bit more than if we each fought for our own and didn't work together. So they see their effort as a conservative movement, and that's part of the thing that has benefited them.
Which the left has lacked, as you're saying in your book, Crashing the Gate, that the left lacks this idea that we are a common movement, we represent a movement, and they're very easily, the groups among the left are very easily set against each other.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem, you know, we aren't the first, obviously, to criticize the constituency groups or the special interest groups, but usually the criticism comes from people that sort of fundamentally disagree with the tactics to begin with, or the positions or the issues to begin with. And we really come, you know, we're pretty strong liberals, and we come from the agreement of these issues, but we really see it more, look, the Democratic Party is the minority party. We're in the opposition. The only way we're ever going to overcome this really strong Republican machine is if we get together and work together.
The blog father, Jerome Armstrong, is our guest. The site is mydd.com. The book is Crashing the Gate. Jerome, hang with me here. Let's take a break at the bottom of the hour for some local news and weather. We'll be right back. This is Charlottesville, right now.
I heard the radio advertisement when I was driving home one night. Just something tugged at my heart. And so I called the next day. I wrote the number down. Andy Foster invited me in, you know, to sit down and talk about CASA.
Piedmont CASA trains volunteers to help abused and neglected children.
With my kids, the first couple times we went to court, I remember them saying, "You're going to be there?" And so I think that kind of gave me a gauge that, of course I'm going to be there, but they want me there, which is makes you feel really good. We need to do our part before it shows up at our door. Just spend a few hours a month, you know, with some kids who would really, really, really benefit from it. My name is Tracy Lewis, and I've been a CASA volunteer for 1 year and 10 months. Every child deserves a safe and permanent home. We need your help. Please call today for more information about becoming a volunteer. Our number is 971-7515.
We're talking with Jerome Armstrong, the blog father. The site is mydd.com. He's the co-author of a new book, Crashing the Gate. And I actually don't have the book in front of me, Jerome, because I lent it to somebody who saw me today and said, "I got to read that." So I actually gave it to him. But what is the subtitle of the book? I can't remember.
It's Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People Power Politics. And we have a website up, crashingthegate.com, that details about what's in the book and a little bit about our backgrounds.
Now, is it too idealistic to say that, because, you know, everybody thought, well, the internet comes along, the internet's going to change everything, it's going to change business, it's going to, you know, and to a certain extent we've been right about some of it, but is it too far of a stretch to say that the internet is really going to change politics in America, or has it already happened?
Well, I think it's in the process of changing it, and these things are going to take time. It's a matter of probably generational shift, because the people that are, and I don't think it's so much the internet as it is just technology in general, because it's changing the way that we use media. You know, people don't necessarily go in front of them, sit down in front of the television to consume media as much as they used to anymore. They do a lot more interactive things with their friends and over the internet that are less passive and more active.
Do you think we might get to a day where every newscast or anything is almost like a blog, where I could instantly stop and comment on it and join a conversation with a group of people from around the world about a news story that we just heard on Fox or CNN?
Yeah, I do. I see that kind of stuff. That will definitely happen. And video is going to be one of the things that we're going to see a lot more of over the internet. You know, how the main way that I think this is changing politics deals with, and it's sort of ironic, because it's really bringing people back together. Throughout most of the last century, politics was about the party. You know, you had to go through things like the party bosses and get local people together to back your candidacy, and that was really how both parties worked. But with the advent of television and television commercials, especially in the 1970s, grew to the point where you didn't really need things like the party to build a candidacy around. You just needed a lot of money put together, and then you could air the right type of television ads, and you could pretty much win off that. Well, that's becoming less and less of a force, and so it's returning to this sort of people-powered politics that really allows the party or the candidacy that has the best field operation out there, the best means to connect to people door-to-door or through the internet, and being able to organize over that way. Those are the parties and the candidacies that are going to win in the future.
And we saw that at work on the national level with the Howard Dean campaign, and your work on his campaign certainly put blogs and the use of the internet on the map with that campaign.
Yeah, but the problem we had was it was still in the infancy in terms of its growth of the online population that was using the internet and being able to organize politically, especially in the critical state of Iowa. We just didn't have enough people that were using that as part of their means for gathering political news and making their decisions.
And so that's a great segue to, well, let's talk then about, if that was in its infancy, where are we now with former Governor Warner? Tell us about your work on his campaign and what that campaign is up to. And it's also interesting, we should point out that, to my knowledge, Governor Warner is the only national political speaker that will be at the conference this weekend in Las Vegas.
Well, Governor Warner comes from a background of understanding technology. You know, he was one of the founders of Nextel, and he understands that it's very dynamic, and whoever is the innovator a lot of times is able to capitalize on and have a competitive advantage, and so he's been very welcome to a lot of the ideas that I've had in terms of how we can use the internet and being able to work with the people that are active over the internet. And certainly the yearly COAST event is one of those opportunities, because here you have 1,000 people that are active in the blog communities, many bloggers, many people that are commenting on the site and writing diaries on the different blogs, that are coming together in Las Vegas for the weekend. And all these people are very politically active locally as well in their grassroots actions locally. And Governor Warner is going to go and speak to the event. We're going to have a huge party Friday night, which ought to be a lot of fun. But then on Saturday, he's going to speak to the entire convention for an hour, and then take question and answers.
So you have to be the key man in terms of getting Warner plugged into that group.
Yeah, well, he has spent a lot of time learning about it. You know, I spend an hour with him every week, just going over what's happening on the net. He reaches out to different bloggers, giving them phone calls, and he's been educated on quite a bit. And whenever he's out on the road traveling, doing fundraisers or political events for other people, I always try to line up whoever the local bloggers are to come to those events and for him to engage with them in that. Over the next month, we're going to have a little bit of Virginia outreach to the blogosphere. We're going to host a Virginia blogger roundtable here at the Forward Together PAC, and it's going to be about a dozen bloggers here in Virginia that are going to come in and meet with the governor and talk about politics here in Virginia and nationally for about an hour and a half.
Let's talk about Governor Warner and his chances for the nomination in some detail here. And by the way, we're speaking with Jerome Armstrong, co-author of Crashing the Gate. He's been called the Blog Father. If you have a question or comment, the phone number is 977-1070. Jerome, what are Governor Warner's chances? Because right now, Hillary Clinton and her... she's got the party bosses in her pockets. I mean, does she not hold on to that party machinery pretty tightly? Lots of money. All the party bosses are sort of lined up in her camp. It's her nomination to lose.
Yeah, but, you know, Marcos and I just went and did this huge book tour where we went to about 20 different states and 35 different cities and just talked with people all over the nation. And if Hillary Clinton had a groundswell, I certainly didn't see it. We didn't see it on the ground much. You know, it's the Democratic Party activist. I think she has raised a lot of money, and if she decides to run, she will be pretty formidable. But I hope Governor Warner decides to run, because I think he's got a great chance. He certainly proved that he's able to govern with a great record here in Virginia. And he's somebody that, you know, when we look at the serious problems that this country faces, it's not going to really be solved by more of this partisan divide and just not addressing the real problems. You know, this week in the Senate, they're debating gay marriage. It's certainly not the highest thing on the radar in terms of the problems this country's facing. And I think Governor Warner is somebody that would take a great deal of responsibility for being able to solve these problems that we face in this nation, things like energy problems that we have, the environmental problem, our foreign policy problems that we have from this administration, and really addressing these in a systematic way. To understanding the whole issue here is, you know, if we don't make these changes here pretty soon, we're going to face some serious problems, both fiscally and environmentally in this country.
But you know what, Jerome, haven't the Republicans shown us that pretty much all you have to do is that all of that is trumped instantly when you start talking about terrorism? And people say, you know, you're right, you may be right, there are some things there we need to address, but I'm worried about my neighborhood being bombed. I'm worried about my school being bombed. And so that trumps everything.
Yeah, fear is a great motivator. You know, and you're right. If you looked at all the issues of John Kerry and George Bush down the line, it would seem like they were all for John Kerry except for the issue of terrorism. And I think the Democratic Party has not done a terrific job at laying out the distinctions between what Democrats believe and what Republicans believe. Certainly John Kerry did in the 2004 election, where despite not finding any weapons of mass destructions or any chemicals within Iraq, he still said he would have voted the same position. You know, that was not a position of principle that he was speaking from. It was a political calculation. And it shows that he's, you know, now changed his mind here a year later. And the Democrats aren't going to be strong enough to provide a distinction between what they believe and what the Republicans are doing over foreign policy, then the people are going to be sort of untrustworthy of them, and it's going to be a wedge that the Republican Party is able to split down there. But I think for the most part, the Democrats have become wise, and we'll probably find out this midterm. You know, we know the Republicans are going to try to do something to wedge that issue again, and we'll see if the Democrats can stand up this time.
Is this and certainly this talk of gay marriage all of a sudden, when we have wars going on overseas and the economy's not doing well, and they're talking about raising interest rates yet again for what, a 17th time, and yet we're talking about gay marriage. I am one of those people who agrees this is absolutely ridiculous. Why are we talking about this, number one, and why are we talking about changing the Constitution of the United States for some social conservative thing? It's just, it blows my mind, and we'll certainly talk about that in detail on this program on another day, but and I just totally lost my train of thought. But
well, they're using this as a basically a political calculation to fire up a portion of their base, but it is ridiculous.
Right, and does it, I guess, remember what I was going to say. You talk about the midterms in November and the elections coming on now. We're seeing that now with this talk of gay marriage. It's yeah, starting now, where we'll get the steady drumbeat of social conservative causes, and yet it's almost like, you know, you're fiddling while Rome is burning. Come on, let's put out the fire.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree with you. And I hope the Democrats can, you know, stand up to that, those sort of shenanigans. And if we can, then we'll have a good chance to win, because that's what really the many of the progressives are sitting back and waiting to see.
Let's go to Bob on line two from Greene County. Bob, go right ahead. Thanks for your call.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I wish I could speak for an hour with you guys. listen, I heard a comment, I guess not more than 45 seconds ago, and I have to address it. I want to call you on it. Please tell me why the economy is bad right now.
Well, I'll tell you, the economy is great at a certain level. But what the problem, and that's at the GDP, and things are being produced. But where the problem is when you look at the wages that people have, then they have not increased. And, you know, he just mentioned inflation a second ago. Prices are going up, gas is going up, but the wages haven't increased for the majority of Americans.
Could you please tell me the percentage of Americans that work for minimum wage?
I don't know about the percentage of Americans working minimum wage, but I'm not only referring to those. I'm talking about middle-class wage earners, people that are on jobs that, you know, pay $40,000 to $60,000 a year. Those wages aren't increasing, but inflation and prices are going up. Gas is up, what, 75% over the last year? People's incomes haven't increased that amount.
How about what, Bob?
How about people's buying power by retail prices being held steady, if not decreasing?
I wasn't aware retail prices were decreasing. I thought they were going up.
Okay,
especially
before you guys start saying that the economy, doom and gloom and all this, you need to check it out. We are an unprecedented amount of growth right now, given the circumstances in this country with the 9/11. And you got
those are caveats. I mean, you can look at,
okay?
I think if you look at the actual income that people are earning over the last few years, you'll see the stats show that it hasn't went up. But, you know, people are being pinched in the pocket right now from things like gas prices that have gone up tremendously.
Right. We're talking with Jerome Armstrong, the blog father. The site is mydd.com. The book is Crashing the Gate. Jerome, hang with me. Let's take one quick break here. We'll be right back. This is Charlottesville right now.
Keep in mind, when we have to go outside the local area to supplement our blood supply, it increases health care costs for everybody.
That's Dr. David Rowe, the medical director of the blood bank at Martha Jefferson Hospital. Martha Jefferson receives blood exclusively from Virginia Blood Services, the only nonprofit local blood supplier serving our Charlottesville and Central Virginia patients.
There's another national and international organization that also collects blood, but it's Virginia Blood Services that collects blood locally and keeps it locally at either UVA or Martha Jefferson hospitals. The most important thing to realize when you donate blood is that that blood is going to help save lives within your own community. That blood is going to serve your friends, your neighbors, and your colleagues within Charlottesville.
Call 1-800-989-4438 to make an appointment to donate today. Help those in need of blood in our local hospitals. It costs nothing but a little bit of your time. Remember, someone's life depends on you.
This is Charlottesville right now.
Our guest this hour has been Jerome Armstrong. The site is mydd.com. Crashing the Gate is the book. Jerome, we heard from Bob in Greene County, and let me ask you this, because it's an important point to be made today. It seems that we have political discourse today. It's like if a liberal says something, instantly you're wrong about everything. And in many respects, the right wing pundits make the left to be out to sound as if there is no good ideas. And I'm neither left nor right. I think there's great ideas on both sides. But I do feel like the right is being made to think that the left is not only wrong about everything, but dangerously wrong. I mean, we've been told that if you're not with me, you're against me. If you're liberal, you support the terrorists. I mean, just crazy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly seems that way at times, and I try not to let the discourse get to that level, because I don't think it really addresses the serious problems. But much of the Republican tactics, though, are involved around lowering the number of people that vote, so that they're able to push through their agenda. They're not really interested in, a lot of people participating in the dialogue, and so. It helps to poison the atmosphere, and that turns off a lot of people from participating in politics.
And that's, the old campaign tactic is when you go negative, you turn away all that big middle bubble, all those moderate voters who are your swing voters, and you bring out your base on your extremes. And that's the end result of which is we have the extremes are now running the show from the right or the left.
Yeah, and that's the Republicans have really based their strategy in order to keep on power on much of that around that issue.
Let me ask you this, just in terms of the any politics in Virginia that you want to comment on. You are a Virginian. You work at the national level, but you are a Virginian. Governor Allen's chances for reelection are sound. Do you think Al Weed can pose it? Or I'm sorry,
well,
that's,
I would,
that's
I don't know, I'm not sure Allen's chances are sound yet. I think. It's an interesting primary, and I don't know who's going to win, but certainly Harris Miller is going to have enough money to challenge him. And Webb has a really interesting biography that I think might appeal to independents, Republicans, and Democrats.
Who do you think could pose more of a challenge to Allen, Harris Miller or Jim Webb?
I think probably it would be Jim Webb.
Who's the more of the centrist of the two?
Well, yeah, and I just sort of look at it as more of the dynamics that are at work in this state, where it's really tough to win if you just have your base up here in Northern Virginia. It's not impossible, certainly, but it is tougher. And he seems to be somebody that would be more easily connected to the more rural areas of the state. Jim Webb,
as opposed to Harris Miller, who's a strong Northern Virginia Democrat.
Yeah, although I find, Harris Miller has great positions on technology, and he was one of the first ones that stepped out on this net neutrality issue and the attempts by the big telecom companies to drive up barriers of cost within the internet. And I don't want to get too much into that. I'd have to describe the whole thing, but it was an important issue for keeping a level playing field on the internet.
Jerome Armstrong, our guest. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you for
your
time.
You're welcome.
And Jerome Armstrong, the site is mydd.com. The book is Crashing the Gate. We've enjoyed speaking with him.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.